Usually when you look at a family tree, there is this expectation of permanence, right? You point to a branch, read a name, and say, well, there they are.
Yeah, you just kind of assume the ink was always set in stone.
Exactly. But today, we are jumping into a deep dive of 17th century French-Canadian family records tailored right to your roots. And let me tell you, the ink on the Lehure family tree was almost wiped out entirely.
It really was. If it wasn't for one fiercely protective widow, the whole legacy might have collapsed. It is just an incredible look at how survival actually worked in early Canada.
Right, because building a legacy there required an immense amount of grit. So we're starting with Simon Leroux. He was born back in 1626 in Perche, France.
Which is obviously a long way from Quebec.
Yeah, and he makes this staggering transatlantic journey to Canada around 1652 alongside his sister's family.
And the migration wave at that time was heavily driven by a colonizationist named Robert Giffard. He was basically recruiting people to build a completely new world.
So Simon answers that call.
Right, he does. And by 1655, he marries Suzanne Jarousseau. They settle down to basically carve a farm out of the wilderness right next to her stepfather.
And looking at the legal transactions from that time, I mean, with literacy rates being so low, spelling the name Leroux basically became a generational game of telephone, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You see the records shift it to Leroux before, eventually settling into the Leroux we know today.
It's wild to think your family name was just, like, fluid.
Well, it makes sense when you think about the daily reality of early colonial life. I mean, a clerk spelling your name differently didn't really matter when you were trying to clear a 58-acre farm in the Canadian winters.
Right. Survival was the priority.
Exactly. Their true identity was forged by working that land and, raising seven children, not by the arbitrary spelling on some land deed.
That is a really good point. But Simon wasn't just isolating his family out in those woods either. He actually became quite a prominent public figure.
He did. He is listed as a godfather, and he even appears in the records of the Sovereign Council of Quebec.
Wait, the Sovereign Council? That was a pretty big deal, right?
Huge. It was the highest governing body in New France. It functioned as the Supreme Court and Administrative Council rolled into one. Just appearing in their records meant you had real standing in the colony.
Okay, see. There's a specific public record from that council noting he paid £38, 5 shillings, for a laborer's passage. But looking at that, it just sounded to me like he was running an errand, like he was managing a transaction for someone wealthier in the community.
You would totally think so. But in the context of early Quebec's economy, dropping £38 in hard currency for a transatlantic passage means he was a major economic player himself.
Wait, really? So it was his own money?
Yes. He was building serious capital. He had the resources to import labor from across the ocean just to expand his own 58-acre operation.
That completely changes the picture. I mean, he's building this thriving operation, but then suddenly it stops. Simon dies in November 1670.
The timing is just brutal.
It is. He actually attends his eldest daughter Marie's wedding from his hospital bed and then passes away just 10 days later.
Which puts a terrifying ticking clock on the family. Because under 17th century colonial law, if a widow didn't immediately establish a legal boundary around her assets,
The state would step in.
oh, remarkably fast, the state or outside creditors could move in to seize property to settle potential debts. And she had seven children to feed. The system offered very little grace.
You'd think a widowed mother in the 1600s would just have to accept whatever the system handed her to survive. I mean, she knows she has to remarry, which she arranges to do with a man named Robert Guettard in 1671.
Right, but Suzanne completely flips the script before that wedding.
She weaponized the legal bureaucracy, didn't she?
Yes. Before she signed any marriage contract, she spent an entire month conducting a meticulous, legally binding inventory of the farm.
And we're talking about everything, the house, the barn, the oven, the utensils.
Right down to a small family mirror.
A mirror. Wow.
Yeah, because by formally inventorying those items under French customary law, she exploited a mechanism that legally locked those specific assets as the strict inheritance of Simon's seven children.
So Robert couldn't touch them.
Exactly. Years later, when Robert tried to claim a share of that original, highly profitable property for the new children he and Suzanne had together, he was legally blocked by that exact inventory.
She forced him to back down.
Yeah.
She ended up leaving him with just the foreman's house and a small plot to cultivate.
So she entirely outmaneuvered him within a deeply patriarchal legal system.
And it worked.
Yeah.
By safeguarding that foundation, her children thrived. Her son, Sixte Leroux, who was born in 1667, inherited that stability.
Right. And he eventually moved to Ile d'Orléans, had 8 children of his own, and permanently cemented the Litterlo name in Canada.
Which brings us right back to that family tree you're exploring today. You know, we see the names, but we rarely see the sheer willpower it took to keep them there.
Yeah, the invisible struggles behind the ink.
Exactly. And it leaves you wondering, if Suzanne hadn't insisted on documenting every single item her family owned, right down to that small family mirror, would the family legacy have survived the harsh realities of early Canada, or would history have erased the Uluru line entirely?